Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, the Turkish government rounds up protesters. The US and EU gear up for the world's biggest ever bilateral trade talks. Lofty ideals from President Obama at the Brandenburg Gate, while Berliners celebrate another American president.
The Berliners have a very strong connection to this day and this speech of JFK. He was at that time the most powerful man in the world. The most important thing is the hope JFK gave to the Berlin people.
Those stories and more coming up on the program. Unprecedented anti-government protests are continuing in Turkey. Not just in Istanbul and the capital Ankara, but in many provincial cities as well. The unrest has become the greatest challenge to Prime Minister Erdogan's decade-old rule. But Erdogan appears determined to crush the movement, and a legal crackdown on protesters has begun. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
The embattled Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is showing no signs of backing down. In fact, he's rallying his supporters in the face of the worst civil unrest in his decade-long rule. In the capital, Ankara, tens of thousands rallied to Erdogan. Despite the protests, he remains to them an all-conquering leader. And the bulldozer of Turkish politics, as he's commonly known, did not disappoint them, with fighting talk and a threat to those who dared to go on the streets to challenge his rule.
Tencere tava çalarak komşusunu rahatsız edenlerden olmadık.
Nobody can intimidate us. We take no orders or instruction from anyone but God. If we don't hold these people to account, we will be cowards. I promise you, we will follow you through the courts.
Çapulcudan çok rahatsız olmuşlar.
Despite such threats, the mood among protesters remains equally defiant. In Istanbul, the demonstrators, beaten back by water cannon and gas and legions of riot police, many flown in from across the country, are now holding nightly protests in parks across the city. For one protester, Erdogan's speech has only confirmed what she is fighting for, although she's aware of the threat.
The Prime Minister addressed to people is, I find it extremely provocative and extremely alienating, actually. And honestly, I don't feel comfortable with this government who is threatening me with the police.
Throughout his years in power, Prime Minister Erdogan has been known as a man who does not make idle threats. And this time is no different.
Beşiktaş taraftar grubu çarşı sabah saatlerinde 22 üyesinin gözaltına alındı.
A Turkish news bulletin announcing dawn raids by the police against protesters. Ahead of the arrests, a minister ironically responsible for the country's European Union membership bid warned that those protesters could be considered terrorists. Emma Sinclair Webb, a researcher for the New York-based Human Rights Watch, says the country's draconian anti-terrorism laws are already being utilised.
Prime Minister and indeed the Interior Minister have suggested it's a kind of coup against the government. There have been two rounds of arrests, one against a particular group of demonstrators who are the Beşiktaş football club fans, the Çarşı group. There's a secrecy order on the investigation, but we do know that they've been held in custody by the organised crime branch of the police, and that would suggest that they are going to be charged with organised criminal activity. But we have a more serious crackdown, massive sweep operation, arresting people from their homes yesterday morning, and those people are suspected of committing terrorism offences. We don't know the full number at the moment. It seems like between 80 and 100.
A demonstrator overwhelmed by a sea of tear gas in Taksim Square, the heart of the nationwide protests. The video clip went viral in Turkey. Social media, especially Facebook and Twitter, have been the mainstay for protesters highlighting police violence, especially in the face of an invariably blind and silent mainstream media. As with the Arab Spring, social media also provides a platform for demonstrators to communicate and get their message out. Yaman Akdeniz, an expert on cyber freedom of Istanbul's Bilgi University, says its importance can only grow in the face of the legal crackdown.
People will now switch more to social media platforms because that's one area that the government authorities have no control over. You can't throw water cannons or tear gas on the social media platform, but they will try to find a way to have a similar impact on social media platforms.
The battle between protesters and the Prime Minister appears to be developing into a war of attrition, with neither side ready to step back. For the protesters, that could well mean being woken by the police banging on the door in the early hours of the morning. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Leaders from the Group of Eight Nations met in Northern Ireland for a two-day summit this week. They reached broad agreement on three major issues: Syria, a crackdown on tax evasion, and a move towards a transatlantic free trade area. British Prime Minister David Cameron declared the talks a success. But as Stephen Beard reports from London, there are serious doubts about how much progress has really been made.
Syria overshadowed the summit. The conflict dominated the first day of the talks. The leaders agreed to step up humanitarian aid and increase diplomatic pressure for peace talks. UK Prime Minister David Cameron said the leaders had achieved a good deal.
A very strong and purposeful statement on Syria that includes, for instance, that there should be a UN investigation into chemical weapons use in Syria, and that should go ahead. I think we have a very strong statement about what needs to happen in Syria.
But the statement papered over some deep divisions. There was no mention of removing Syrian President Assad. Russia backs him. The US and the UK in particular are adamant that he should go. And while the US favours arming some of the rebels, Russia's Vladimir Putin said that would only destabilise Syria further.
We take the view that any decision to provide the opposition with weapons, based on unconfirmed accusations against Damascus of using chemical weapons, will only exacerbate the situation.
The best that the summiteers could manage on Syria was to agree that peace talks should be held in Geneva as soon as possible, but there was no date or timetable for those talks. On the summit's key economic theme, a crackdown on tax evasion, Cameron insisted there had been a breakthrough.
These are really strong commitments that have never been written down in this sort of way, and then signed. Everyone put their name to these 10 commitments.
The key commitments are that tax authorities around the world should automatically share information with each other about their citizens' tax affairs. And the G8 agreed multinational companies should reveal what tax they pay and where they're paying it. Sol Orihuela campaigns on behalf of developing countries, and she welcomed the commitments.
What's really important for us is that it's not only tax that it's discussed, but it's that the developing country angle comes across really strongly. Developing countries lose around $160 billion every year due to tax dodging.
Margaret Hodge, chairperson of the British Parliament's Public Accounts Committee, also congratulated David Cameron for pushing through the initiative.
It's a welcome and important move on the sort of journey of dealing with aggressive tax avoidance and evasion. What he's done is put it firmly on the political agenda.
But Hodge has some reservations about the language of the G8 communique, not sufficiently binding, she feels.
They should share information. Should is not good enough. It's will that matters. And we need to know, of course, the detail of how and when these shoulds are going to be translated.
Britain said it will go ahead with a register of ownership and taxation to stop British companies and rich individuals dodging tax by hiding their identities in offshore havens. And the UK will consult on whether that information will be available to the public. But only Britain made that commitment.
I think my only other criticism is that the other countries didn't sign up to the public knowing about how global enterprises distribute their profits and their tax liabilities.
The US and Europe also used the summit to launch the US-EU free trade negotiations. They'll formally begin next month. They aim to remove the last remaining barriers to trade between the world's two richest markets. José Manuel Barroso, head of the European Commission, said in Northern Ireland that this would provide a much-needed boost for Europe.
When this agreement is up and running, the European economy will get a stimulus which translates into tens of billions of euros every year and tens of thousands of new jobs.
But that glittering prospect could be delayed by a new stumbling block. The furore over internet surveillance by the US National Security Agency could derail the trade talks. US companies have been pressing for fewer restrictions on cross-border data flows. But privacy campaigner Nick Pickles says the Europeans are now likely to press for even more restrictions. He says the revelations about US spying undermine the whole cause of free trade.
I think one of the concerns that does come out of the shocking revelations about what the NSA has been doing is that people may well not see the US as a place that they can trust to do business with, and that's got to have massive repercussions for the global economy.
But other observers point out that state surveillance has not apparently deterred European companies from doing business with China. And they argue that anyway there are plenty of other obstacles in the path of a US-EU free trade deal. As with the G8's other declarations, there will be much hard work before we attain nirvana. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
Well, after the G8 summit in Northern Ireland, President Barack Obama headed to the German capital, where he met with Chancellor Angela Merkel and gave a sweeping speech at the city's historic landmark, the Brandenburg Gate.
Hello, Berlin! Well, thank you, Chancellor Merkel, for your leadership, your friendship, and the example of your life. From a child of the East to the leader of a free and united Germany.
In this postcard from Berlin, Alexei de Voorsten reflects on Obama's presence, a sharp contrast from his visit when he was a presidential candidate 5 years ago.
Everything about President Obama's appearance at Berlin's famous backdrop was symbolic, except the bulletproof glass that shielded him from his cheering audience, evoking the historic relationship between the United States and the post-war Federal Republic. He spoke on the east side of the towering columns that once stood in the capital of communist East Germany. Equally towering were the ideals of freedom and tolerance he addressed in his wide-ranging speech. His calls for a reduction in Russian and American nuclear arsenals, already snubbed by Moscow, were almost buried under the lofty visions that somehow sounded more convincing the last time he was here. Back then, he was hailed as a hero by 200,000 souls. It was July 2008, just over a month after he'd sealed the Democratic presidential nomination, and the atmosphere was heady with hope. Since Chancellor Merkel had declared the Brandenburg Gate off-limits except to elected presidents, the then-Senator Obama spoke instead at another famous landmark, the Victory Column, which in a way was even more appropriate, because for many, the prospect of an Obama victory was such a tantalizing departure from 8 years of the Bush administration. Poll after poll suggested that if Obama were running for office in Europe, he'd have won by a 90% majority. And 7 months ago, there was widespread relief in this continent when he was reelected. What a difference a drone makes, or 7,000 of them by some estimates. While American parents of soldiers killed in Iraq or Afghanistan might argue in favor of drones given their own tragic loss, there's little appreciation of them here. Add to that the failure to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, along with the revelations of broad surveillance by the U.S. National Security Agency, and the result is disillusionment and not a little alienation. Thanks to social media, the quip, "Yes, we scan," has spread quickly here. It can be argued that German expectations of President Obama were unrealistic. But given this country's horrific habit of spying on its citizens during both Nazi and communist dictatorships, today's privacy protection laws enjoy something amounting to sacred cow status. So Chancellor Merkel had good reason, especially in an election year, to confront President Obama about the NSA's long reach into Europeans' phone and internet data. During his speech, Obama appeared to address this when he harked back to the Cold War, saying, "We can keep each other safe while maintaining the values we fought for." The audience, this time by invitation only, applauded. But it's not clear exactly how this equation will work out in real terms. In reaching out to what he called all members of our human family, the president also warned against complacency. Just because great moments of history have delivered our liberties, he said, doesn't mean our work is done. He urged support of the struggle for freedom and prosperity in the Arab world and the fight to end hunger. He noted the urgency of averting climate change, the importance of gender equality, and greater recognition of gay and lesbian rights. 50 years after President John F. Kennedy's famous speech in West Berlin, there was a lot of ground to cover. To skeptical Berliners with a disappointed sense of déjà vu, and that includes the 20,000 Americans who live here, what Obama seemed to be saying was, "Don't give up. I dare you to believe in these ideals and make a difference." Alexa Divorson, DW Radio, Berlin.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. And from one American president to another. And next Wednesday, it'll be 50 years since John F. Kennedy visited the divided city of Berlin. At the Schöneberg Town Hall, he gave an historic speech and uttered those legendary words, "Ich bin ein Berliner." It was a show of support and solidarity from the strongest democratic nation in the world. Berlin is celebrating the 50th anniversary of that occasion with great fanfare. Scores of events are taking place to commemorate Kennedy's visit. Leah MacDonald hit the streets of Berlin to find out if the name John F. Kennedy still resonates as strongly today as it did back then. On June 26, 1963, the western part of divided Berlin came to a standstill. John F. Kennedy, President of the United States of America and leader of the free world enjoying rock star status, was in town. Schools and businesses shut as people took to the streets to get a glimpse of the man that embodied their deepest wishes for hope and freedom.
All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, "Ich bin ein Berliner."
The Berliners have a very strong connection to this day and this speech of JFK.
That's Christian Tensler, spokesperson for Visit Berlin, the city's official tourism office.
JFK was a very charismatic person, very, very charismatic. And he was at that time the most powerful man in the world. You have to remember in what kind of situation the people were, the building of the wall. The people were really frustrated and they suffered. The most important thing of the speech is the hope JFK gave to the Berlin people. And this is still in the memory of the people.
At the city's Kennedy Museum, you can watch footage of that speech. The museum's director, Alinza Heinze, says when Berliners watch it, they often remember their experiences that day.
Some of them tell me fantastic stories, how much it meant to them that he came there and how much hope and confidence it gave the people of West Berlin, and I think the people of West Germany as well, that he said that the Allies are with them and are there to support the people here and they know how hard it is for them.
Anke Stern was just 16 at the time of Kennedy's visit, but still remembers it vividly.
I went with my girlfriend there about 9 o'clock. We were in front of the town hall of Schöneberg in the first row. I think it was noontime when the car of President Kennedy arrived. Well, he was a very good-looking man, and he had very much charm. And the way he was speaking, he was gentle speaking, he was not screaming. He spoke and with a very warm voice, and you could say he had a lot of charisma here.
For it is, as your mayor has said, an offense not only against history, but an offense against humanity.
The feeling was amazing, hopeful, especially when he spoke the German sentence, "Ich bin ein Berliner." And we thought it would change something. Everybody was doubting a little bit that the Allied would stay forever in Berlin, and the Russians, the East Bloc, seemed to be stronger and stronger, and we were surrounded by Russian tanks, and so it was a fulfilled promise from the President of the United States to that they will stay and defend this free city.
To celebrate the 50th anniversary of JFK's Berlin speech, the Kennedy Museum is presenting a special exhibition of photos of his 1963 German tour, including photos taken by local citizens. But that's just one of the numerous events being organized in the city. Christian Tensler from Visit Berlin again.
We have more than 50 events, some exhibitions, for example, in the German Historical Museum, in the Allied Museum, and we have, of course, discussion panels. And for me, what is something very special is there is a tour on a bus, but this bus has special video screens, and it follows the route JFK had traveled during his visit. And you can see how the streets looked in 1963, with the old videos in the bus as you pass by.
For older Berliners, Kennedy's visit is still very poignant. But what about the younger generation here? Do they even know who the man is? I did a bit of polling at my local community center to find out. 13-year-old Miriam sums up the general consensus of the teenage crowd here to the question, do you know who John F. Kennedy is?
No, I don't know who John F. Kennedy is.
Do you know any famous Americans that have visited Berlin?
A famous American that I know has visited Berlin is Justin Bieber.
Naturally, Justin Bieber, not Kennedy, is the unparalleled coolster ruler of the teeny world. Still, like his predecessor Kennedy, the current U.S. president is one politician who knows the value of such symbolic gestures. Museum director Alinza Heinze says many parallels exist between Obama's political image and Kennedy's that help young museum visitors grasp Kennedy's historical significance.
We have a lot of students coming here, and what I always like to talk to them about is that, for example, the Obama campaign, first campaign, that there is a lot of similarities between the Kennedy campaign and the Obama campaign. So it's for the students, it's interesting to see that the things Kennedy once said and what he stands for is that is still relevant today.
No other American politician has ever won over the hearts and minds of the German people the way JFK did. President Obama probably came the closest when he visited the city in 2008 with his message of hope and change. Christian Tensler says the Berliners' affection for Obama comes as no surprise.
Obama is, for some reason, he's the new Kennedy. He stands for a liberal, open-minded American. Freedom in Berlin has a very high value because we lost our freedom. Obama is a symbol for freedom as well. People who have the symbol of freedom are in the hearts of the people here.
Whether Obama's visit and legacy will be celebrated with equal fanfare as JFK's in 50 years' time remains to be seen. In the meantime, this month Berliners will revel in paying tribute to the memory of their favorite honorary, Berliner. Leah McDonald, DW, Berlin.
Well, JFK's speech is the inspiration for this month's quiz. Now, the president wrote down Ich bin ein Berliner phonetically so that he could say it properly. And we want you to send us his written phonetic version of that phrase. Our email address is europe@dw.de. Or write to us at Inside Europe, the English service, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We have 5 prizes to give away and we'll announce the winners next month. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Over the next half hour, a battle in Denmark over how it should present its wartime past.
I think the paradoxes that riddled any Dane during those 5 years, between the imperative to stand up and fight and defend our freedom, but also the imperative to somehow get along with the occupying power, and the new museum has to focus on the fight for freedom, but it has to put this fight into the wider context.
Also on the programme, Italy's first black politician faces racism, and will bring you a truly European love story which has lasted more than 70 years. Stay tuned for those stories and more. Italy's first black cabinet minister has triggered a storm of reaction in a country still grappling with the relatively recent phenomenon of immigration. Cécile Kyenge was named Minister of Integration by Italy's recently chosen Prime Minister Enrico Letta. Kyenge, an eye doctor raised in the Republic of Congo, isn't the only immigrant in the country's parliament. But as Megan Williams reports from Rome, as the first black government minister, she's become a lightning rod for racist and sexist concerns.
When 49-year-old Dr. Cécile Kyenge became Italy's first black cabinet minister this April, it didn't take long for the racist slurs to begin. Congolese monkey, member of a Bonga Bonga government, was the reaction from members of the country's anti-immigration Northern League party. Then, last week, something even more shocking. A posting on the Facebook page of Northern League town councillor Dolores Valandro that said, "Why doesn't someone rape Kyenge so she can understand what victims of this atrocious crime feel?" Valandra posted the comment to imply that immigrants were responsible for most violent assaults in Italy. The remark triggered an immediate and widespread condemnation, even from Northern League members, who called for Valandro's resignation. But for years, other similar racist and sexist comments have been quietly tolerated, especially in the soccer stadium. There, national stars like Mario Balotelli have had to put up with racist chants, long accepted by many Italians as just part of the game. Balotelli has threatened to walk off the field, and in other instances, whole teams have indeed done just that. But so far, Balotelli has kept on playing. But having a high government official who is not only African, but whose task as Minister of Integration is to help advocate for immigrants, still often marginalized in Italy, could be the real game changer here. Kyenge, who moved to Italy to study medicine in 1983 and who's married to an Italian, understands intimately what she's up against. Asked whether she considers Italy a racist country, she's careful in her response.
That's a tough question. I've always said, though, that Italy isn't a racist country. It's a country that needs to get to know more about migration and the value of diversity. And maybe what's missing most here is a culture of immigration. Only after the country has processed these things can we say whether it's racist or not.
While other European countries have been grappling with integration issues for decades, the arrival of immigrants here is fairly new. Foreigners made up about 2% of Italy's population in 1990. Now they make up 7.5%. Kyenge says the first thing she wants to do is change Italy's citizenship law to allow children born in Italy of legal immigrants to obtain citizenship more easily. It's policies like that that have in part enraged Italians already against immigration and lead to threats. Kyenge says the threats are par for the course.
No, I'm not afraid. The insults and threats against me are because I'm in a visible position now. But they're really threats against anyone who resists racism, who resists violence.
Well, I think just being herself, the fact that she is a black woman, means that she becomes a target for all the most virulent forms of racism and sexism in Italy. Whereas somebody who says the same sorts of things as she does, and indeed her predecessor's policies were not hugely different, but he was a male, Catholic, white, and didn't get any personal offense although lots of people didn't like his policies. By being her, she gets it.
James Walston is a political commentator and expert on Italian society from the American University in Rome. He says things are changing in Italy. He points to the fact that now in Parliament there are three other members born outside Italy, and that the recently elected mayor of the northern city of Vicenza, a Northern League hotbed, is an immigrant, one who replaced an openly racist former mayor. Walston says the growing profile of immigrants here is forcing Italy to grapple with its long-tolerated casual racism.
The positive aspect of all this extremely unpleasant language, and so far it's only language, is that it does mean that a lot of other people who are offended as much as she is say so and support her. When a member of the Northern League says that Kyenge should be raped in order to know what it's like, it's not only good, nice liberals who are shocked, but it's also her party leaders who have to say this is unacceptable and expel her from the party.
That lack of tolerance has emerged in other unexpected moments. Last month, when an African refugee suffering from a psychotic episode killed several Italians with an axe in Milan, the Northern League moved into the neighborhood to recruit members. Instead, what they got was chased away by citizens, irate that they would use the tragedy to encourage hate against immigrants. These sorts of events are not yet as widespread as the racist threats and slurs. But as Italy is forced to change, there's hope that they soon will be. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
A report published by Latvia's security services says that ethnic Russian children in the country are being offered free trips to youth military training camps in Russia. The report says they're being emotionally and psychologically influenced by ideological lectures and displays of Russia's military might. Only around 20 teenagers have participated in the camp so far, but Latvian politicians see the training as a threat to national security. A reporter, Gerets Gelzis, in Riga, has more.
It's been 2 years already that teenagers from the Russian-speaking minority of Latvia have been making trips to youth military training camps in Russia. The participation is paid for by the Russian government, and last year a training camp happened in Velikiye Luki, a town in western Russia. The camp was entitled Union Heirs to the Victory, referring to the Second World War when the Soviet Union and the Allies defeated Hitler's Germany. Teams from countries like Belarus, Ukraine and Armenia participated in the camp. There were also participants from the Baltic states, including 12 teenagers from Latvia. 17-year-old Yevgenia Rzubova was among them. Here's what she said about the camp to Russian TV channel REN-TV.
This is the first time that I have participated in such a competition. And I can say that I'm very satisfied with the event. Here we did various exercises and participated in different military games. For example, I played paintball and took part in other types of competitions.
A video posted on the camp's website shows kids wearing military camouflage and carrying weapons. They're running, climbing, singing songs and saluting military servicemen, and it's obvious that the children are having a good time. That said, it's the nature of the camp that is a cause of concern, says Arts Pabriks. He's the defense minister of Latvia.
It's not only Russia's foreign ministry and military forces that support these camps. Russia's secret agencies do too.
Pabrik says that participants of the event are involved in a glorification of the Russian armed forces and Soviet history. And for instance, they're being taught espionage by Russia's military servicemen. Pabrik says that it's a threat to national security because the kids return to Latvia as patriots of another country.
Russia wants to use ethnic Russian youths living in Latvia and put ideological pressure on them. It wants to brainwash these kids into supporting the actions of Russia's soft power or by winning people's hearts and minds. And that's how Russia wants to strengthen its control in the Baltic region.
According to Pabrix, Russia wants to reintegrate Latvians into a post-Soviet sphere of influence by stealth. In other words, it uses culture, economics and moral values instead of force to influence society. And these youth camps are just one tool, says Pabrix. But Anna Bakanach in Moscow, one of the organizers of the camp, denies the accusations. She says that it's an international event which aims to encourage cultural diversity among children.
I understand that there are objections against the relation to the Soviet Union, but the camp can only be associated with it because of its name, Union Heirs to the Victory. Of course, the name represents the countries which participated in the Second World War. Though the Soviet Union was a huge and strong superpower, it's clear to everyone that it has not come back, and that no one has tried nor is trying to revive it.
That said, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, wants to establish the Eurasian Union, a political and economic bloc which would also include the former Soviet states. The Latvian security forces say that Russia has been investing considerable amounts of money to strengthen ties with Russian minorities in the former Soviet republics to help further the idea of this Eurasian Union. And there have been many pro-Russian cultural events taking place in Latvia since the year 2000, says Rinalds Gulbis. He's a researcher at the Center for East European Policy Studies in Riga.
The thing is that these camps are a clear example of Russia using soft power and taking what could be viewed as simple cultural events to the next stage. I mean, the youths and people in general are now being involved in practical activities and military training.
Gulbi says that there is a large Russian-speaking minority in Latvia, and half of them, or around 300,000 people, are non-citizens. They are reluctant to gain Latvian citizenship, and many of them are sentimental about the Soviet past. And these kinds of feelings are fertile ground for Russia to target, says Gulbis.
The most upsetting fact is that the youths in the camp had to sign a memorandum where they promised to protect Russia and its values. They vowed to support the spread of the Russian language, culture, and to defend Russian politics. The question is, does that match our Latvian values?
Both Pabrix and Gulbi say that Latvia needs to do more to involve kids in patriotic military camps here in Latvia to counteract what they see as Russian infiltration. In the meantime, the Foreign Ministry has signaled to Russia that involvement of Latvian youths in its military camps doesn't improve mutual relations between the countries. Yadar Diels is DW, Riga.
A battle is underway in Denmark over the future of the country's resistance museum, dedicated to the memory of the underground movement which fought the Germans during the Second World War. The National Museum, that oversees its smaller partner, has provoked fury by announcing that the Resistance Museum is to incorporate other elements of Denmark's war history, such as collaboration with the Germans. The changes have been made possible because the Resistance Museum was destroyed by arson. Malcolm Brabant reports.
This is a song that was popular in the middle of the 1940s, when resistance fighters were sabotaging infrastructure and German supply lines and assassinating collaborators and Nazi informants. But now the time capsule commemorating their deeds has itself been sabotaged, or more accurately, deliberately set on fire. All the artifacts were salvaged unscarred, so that a new museum can rise from the ashes. But resistance survivors, now in their 80s, are afraid their legacy will be diluted and are fighting to stop plans to expand the theme of the replacement exhibition.
When I was very young, 17, 18 years old, I cut German telephone lines and such things. When I was 18, 19 years old, the last year of the war, I was bicycle courier for a group which worked directly under the Freedom Council.
Jens Eyer is chairman of the Danish Veterans Association.
I think that we shall keep focus on the resistance movement and the armed fight.
Why?
Because that was really important for Denmark, that we had this fight. And it was a very fine thing that so many people were ready to offer their lives in the fight against the Germans. The memory of that should never be forgotten.
Jo, tænd nu den lampe.
Det bliver jo ikke det pres.
3! 5
seconds
to jump
off.
Yep. 4!
3, 2, 1, go!
The film Vidstengruppen, or White Rock Group, celebrates a company of resistance fighters in western Denmark who smuggled British arms to comrades elsewhere in the country. They helped to uplift Denmark's reputation, damaged by the failure to fight the German army when it invaded in 1940, and subsequent widespread collaboration with the Nazi occupiers. Bo Lidegaard is a historian and editor of the left-leaning Politiken newspaper.
I think the paradoxes that riddled any Dane during those 5 years, between the imperative to stand up and fight and defend our freedom, but also the imperative to somehow get along with the occupying power and to make the day one at the time in order to survive. And this paradox, both the politicians, the population, the industry, the agriculture, all of them face these paradoxes. The new museum has to focus on the fight for freedom, but it has to put this fight into the wider context.
Hello. Hello. Hitler is calling.
In this scene from the film, fighters are strafed by a German warplane. As the movie shows, the resistance movement's bravery encapsulated a spirit that made Denmark unique in that it helped most of its Jewish population to escape to Sweden. And that generated a loyalty that has lasted through the decades.
No!
Bent Bludnikoff is a Jewish historian and journalist.
What young people are really interested in is not the grey corporation policy of the politician. They want the story of the moral people that risk their lives. So I'm afraid that if it's going to be a broad exhibition, we miss the young people. They want the courageous things.
But it looks like the old men will suffer a partial defeat as the National Museum intends to expand the nature of Denmark's wartime history. The National Museum is in charge of the restoration project and says it's unrealistic for an exhibition to offer just one-dimensional answers to the conflict. Pierre Kjærsgaard is the former leader of the right-wing Danish People's Party.
The idea of incorporating the collaboration I find to be treason towards the resistance fighters.
This is the song that Danes sing every May the 5th to celebrate the day in 1945 when the country was liberated from the Germans. They pay homage in a lush glade on the outskirts of Copenhagen by three stakes scarred by bullet holes to which captured resistance fighters were tied and executed by Nazi firing squads. The person who tried to erase their memory by burning down the museum is still at large. Malcolm Brabant, DW, Copenhagen.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. And finally today, a truly European love story. One which has spanned more than half a century, crossed borders and transcended politics. It involves an Italian, a Ukrainian and a statue. And here's Emma Wallace to fill in the gaps.
Ascoltate! La dichiarazione di guerra è già stata consegnata agli ambasciatori.
On June the 10th, 1940, Benito Mussolini, the Italian fascist leader, took Italy into the Second World War against Britain and France. By 1943, Italian soldier Luigi Peduto found himself in Croatia, holding the line near the town of Split, when an armistice was suddenly announced.
Il governo italiano, riconosciuta la impossibilità di continuare la imparilotta, ha chiesto un armistizio al generale Eisenhower.
Luigi and his fellow soldiers were rounded up, frog-marched on foot to Budapest, and then taken by train to an Austrian forced labor camp. And that's where he met Mokrina Urzuk, a Ukrainian woman he calls Maria.
Mentre scavavamo, diciamo, noi italiani, c'erano tre donne russe. Tra le quali una era Maria.
There were three Ukrainian women, as well as us Italians. And one day, when we had a break, I saw this woman. She was young, just 23 or 24 years old. I'd been in Croatia 2 years, so I'd picked up some of the language there, and it's not too dissimilar from Russian, so I could say a few words.
And Mokrina recalls connecting with Luigi in an interview she gave to the Ukrainian newspaper Fakti e Komentari.
I was asked to help a tall, good-looking Italian mix cement for a new barracks we were working on. I couldn't speak Italian, so we could only smile at each other, laugh and flirt. But we soon established a rapport and made sure we could be together whenever it was possible.
On hearing that Mokrina had a child, Luigi, a tailor by trade, tried to help her, bringing extra food that he was given in return for sewing things for fellow prisoners.
A prima vista no, perché lei non dava nessun...
It wasn't love at first sight, because she was very cool and didn't open up very quickly. But what made me fall in love with her was when she said that she had a little girl, because that really tugged at my heartstrings.
The couple only learnt a few words of each other's language, but their bond seemed strong. So strong that it continued after the war, when they were sent home to their respective countries.
Mi sposai nel 52.
I married, had children, grandchildren, but I still kept Maria's photo with me. I didn't forget her. Here it is. It's always with me. I also have a lock of her hair here. You can see it.
And then, in 2004, fate intervened.
У меня большой дом в Италии, в Кастель Сан-Лоренцо.
With the help of a Ukrainian friend in his town near Naples, Luigi, by now widowed, wrote to a Russian TV show which helped reunite lost loves in the hope that they could help him find his Maria.
Questo è avvenuto verso i primi di giugno del 2004, come oggi.
We waited and we waited and we waited. Months went past. June, July, August, September. And then on the 11th of October, which happens to be my birthday, I was at home alone, and then there was a telephone call. They asked me if I was Luigi Peduto, and I said, yes, that's me.
The producers of the show told him that they wanted to fly Luigi to Moscow to reunite him with Mokrina.
E io il giorno presto vado a Salerno a farmi il passaporto.
So I went immediately to Salerno and I got my passport sorted out. I was just so moved, I couldn't contain myself. I went to Moscow and on the second evening I went on TV and Maria came out. Everyone was clapping and I was so happy and Maria was there before me. I was totally moved to tears.
When you watch that TV footage, Maria is clearly more stalwart than Luigi. She submits to his embrace, but doesn't appear to be quite as moved as him, as she told the Ukrainian newspaper.
When I saw Luigi, I just couldn't believe my eyes. He looked so different. Back then, he was tall and thin. Now he was well built. But I could still see he was nice. And there, underneath, were those same blue eyes. He screamed out, Maria, and hugged me and kissed me. He kept calling me my little dumpling over and over again. And he pulled out the lock of my hair that he'd kept from when we'd parted.
Fatti che non mi posso mai raccontare queste cose. It's Luigi, sono Luigi.
And then I said, it's Luigi, Luigi. And I just burst into tears. But she didn't. I've never seen her cry. Never. I was just a mess, crying all over the place, repeating over and over again, I'm Luigi! I'm Luigi!
Luigi!
Ти що, здурієш, йому казала, що Маріну не треба косити?
Хоч.
Не треба!
After that encounter in 2004, TV companies took the couple to each other's houses in Ukraine and Italy. There were hopes the couple might get married, but Luigi remembers Maria's reaction when the journalists asked Maria about a possible proposal.
She came out of her house and she laughed. She just wouldn't respond. That was absurd. How should she have responded? How could she accept a proposal?
Nevertheless, Luigi kept in touch, sending packets of Parmesan cheese and other things he thought might help Mokrina in her remote village. News spread of his continuing devotion to her, so much so that in May this year, the city of Kiev took the unusual step of erecting a statue of the couple to commemorate their love story. The town's chief architect, Sergei Selovalnik, explained that he hoped their example would inspire others to create enduring relationships.
We can see two aged persons in their 90s, and they still lovers. They love each other. And this is like an example for new youngsters to see and to look that it can be so strong feeling like bronze, like they can remember that and come to it, touch it and say, okay, our feeling will be the same strong like these two people demonstrating in bronze.
And it certainly seems to be working. The statue is right next to what's known as the Lover's Bridge, and it attracts foreign visitors and locals who all seem taken by the story.
I love it. This statue recognizes ordinary people, and that's nice. Even after so much time, they never forgot each other, and they still searched each other out. This is all about the meaning of life, which is love. That's life for me.
When I heard this story, I had tears in my eyes. It is just so wonderful. And it was funny watching them get together in the Ukrainian village too. I laughed a lot at that.
I think beautiful story. Look, I mean, it's great that we have something like this here. I think it was a very good idea to put this here, right? It wakes up some of the best feeling inside of every person.
Back at his home near Naples, Luigi is planning a trip to Ukraine this August to see the statue and Mokrina. That's if his and her health permit. He seems to enjoy the fame his love story has brought him.
When they know that Luigi and Maria are going there, the whole world will mobilise. The cameras and everything, all the emotions. Oh, I just feel overwhelmed already. The statue of me and her, the whole world knows about it. It was just so wonderful to have our story recognised. I just don't know how to express myself, but it's just beautiful. Even words can't describe that. You just have to imagine it. I feel overwhelmed already.
But you know, you're not dreaming, signore. Excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore. Amore, that's amore.
Emma Wallace with the enduring European love story that knows no borders. Thanks for joining me for this week's show. It was produced with help from sound engineer Thomas Schmidt, who was pushing all the right buttons in the studio. I'm Helen Sini. We'll be back at the same time next week. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn.